Thank you all for coming. I appreciate it. As Thad said, I'm a research professor at the Institute of Social Research, but mostly a psychologist in the Department of Psychology at the University of Michigan. And over the past 15 or 20 years or so, basically my research has focused on trying to understand the nature and sources of variability in children's development, mostly literacy development recently, over what is called the school transition period. And basically that encompasses now 3 years of age up through third grade. And the work that I've done is sort of embedded in a long tradition of research trying to understand literacy in America. In fact, I'd thought about titling the talk Improving Literacy in America, but that might be sort of promising too much. What we've learned, I think, over the past 15 or 20 years is that basically American students have shown great variability in their language, cognitive, social, academic, and related skills that predicts their success in school. But what we've learned really, perhaps more dramatically in the last 10 years, is how early those individual differences emerge. That by at least 2 to 3 years of age, significant differences across language skills, cognitive skills, and other emergent literacy skills, as they are called, basically appear and without appropriate intervention can become sort of crystallized and predict long-term gains or lack thereof in children much later in life. Secondly, over and above that, what we've learned is that that variation is a function of a lot of different factors in the child, in the home environment, in the schooling environment, and the larger sociocultural context. So basically, trying to understand what's producing that variability, when and how great it is complicated and has really taken us a while to sort of figure out. Beyond that, these sources are not independent of each other. They interact. So child factors interact with schooling, as I'll hope to demonstrate in the next few minutes. And so that complicates things. And in fact, the variable early schooling experiences that children have over and above the individual differences that appear before school entry can exacerbate children's development and produce even greater individual differences. So what I thought I would do is to start out, I mean, we could talk all night, and I give a whole seminar on this particular graph, is to talk about basically what we're sort of trying to understand here is children's ongoing achievement, or if you will, their success in school. But looking over that school transition period, there are factors before children get to school and once children start school. So essentially, you can see that there are child factors, and I'm going to talk about some of those. Parenting factors, we'll get into that. Preschool and child care, which I'm not going to talk about, but which is really important. And then broader sociocultural factors that also independently and interactively affect children's development and achievement. Those factors all operating before children get to school, they carry forward and interact with the schooling experience, including things like the teacher qualifications and a very important factor now in trying to understand what's going on in schools, instruction. So, and this is not even all that one could, in fact, talk about. But it gives you a sense of the complexity of this issue and how difficult it is to get your arms around, you know, what are the factors that produce success in school and later on. So what I'm going to do, though, is talk about three sort of sets of factors in the child, in a school, and in parenting. that I think have been found to be really critical and where we might, in fact, find ways to actually make a difference. There are lots of other things that we could talk about, and obviously, if you want to raise issues about childcare or larger sociocultural issues, we can do that too. But mostly what I've focused on are these child factors, schooling factors, and parenting factors. So I'm going to talk about some of the research that we've done there. So if we start with child factors first. Most of us, sort of when we think about success in school, think about reading, writing, and arithmetic, the basic academic skills that children learn when they're in school. But one of the factors that has emerged over the past 10 years or so that turns out to be dramatically predictive of children's school success is a skill, if you will, a process that goes by many different names, but generally it's called self-regulation. And it is essentially children's ability to inhibit inappropriate responses, attend to things and not be distracted, plan and organize their behavior. We'll talk about that a little bit more. Really what most people sort of think of it is self-control or self-management. And that's exactly the skill that my 5-year-old son didn't have in kindergarten. So on the report card, when it said self-control, it was NI, needs improvement. So that gives you a sense, though, I think, of how early this emerged and how important it is. Self-regulation, when you look at it from a psychological perspective, from the underlying processes that sort of produce it, there are three sorts of skills that psychologists have focused on: attentional control or attentional flexibility. Again, the ability to focus on relevant and ignore irrelevant information, but to switch attention when you need to from one task to another. Secondly, working memory, which essentially is the ability to remember something, but also remember it while you're doing something else. The classic example, I think, that I give for people is a prospective memory example where you're upstairs and you think, oh, I could really use a glass of milk or a glass of orange juice or whatever, and you walk down the stairs thinking about something else. You go to the refrigerator, you open the door. Oh, why did I come here? That's working memory, okay? Don't ask me about getting old and working memory, okay? That's another story. And finally, response inhibition, which, again, was my son's problem. The ability to inhibit an inappropriate response in the service of learning a more appropriate response. Now, self-regulation normally involves all three of these together. But neurophysiologists, cognitive psychologists have been able to tease these apart as separate factors, at least in adults. So what's interesting about this is it's been the focus of a lot of different disciplines in psychology, from geneticists all the way up to cross-cultural people. And that's posed some confusion in the field that I'm hopefully will clarify in just a few minutes. There are three developmental epochs, according to recent research, that when self-regulation is accelerated in its development. The first one is between 18 and 36 months, then between about 5 and 7 or 8 years of age, and then in adolescence. You've heard of adolescents getting their act together. It might actually be a neurophysiological phenomenon. Really, the critical issue about this new skill that we're thinking about is the extent to which it's under maturational influence, or if you will, the extent to which it's flexible or malleable. And that really raises the issue in sort of educational circles of, you know, we focus on reading, writing, and arithmetic, but in most instances, we really don't focus on things like self-regulation. They're supposedly learned on their own, or maybe not learned on their own, or they mature. But we really don't see them as the object of instruction or of classroom experiences. And that's an issue I think we should discuss, because there's increasing evidence that things like self-regulation and other what are called soft skills, which is a complete misnomer, but are maybe, you know, as important, if not more important, than some of the basic literacy and numeracy skills that really are taught in school. So what I'm going to do is review some current work that we've done on this thing called self-regulation. We looked at, you know, how early do individual differences emerge? To what extent does self-regulation independently contribute to school achievement? And is it malleable? can we find evidence that schooling experiences in particular might shape it independently? Okay. Just so you get the idea that this isn't some sort of academic exercise, I sort of picked these out from a few years ago from newspapers showing that study charges New Jersey preschools kicking kids out. Expulsion rate highest for preschoolers, study shows. So this variability on the surface, I think, is not only evident, but it could actually have some really serious psychological consequences at the lower end of the distribution. Okay, just briefly, one other thing I just want to talk about is that this construct called self-regulation, or we're going to call it self-regulation, has been sort of the object of study of neuroscientists, cognitive scientists, developmental scientists, a lot of different people, and they have given it different names based and have measured it in very different ways. And that's produced what I've called sort of a disciplinary isolation. So you may have heard different terms for this thing. Some people call it executive function. Some call it self-regulation. You may have heard the term effortful control or work-related skills. These are all terms in the general domain of self-regulation, or if you will, getting your act together. And at the same time, different disciplines have had to develop different ways of measuring this thing. So I've said on some occasions that this has created, at least in our research field, a kind of conceptual clutter and a measurement mayhem. Now, that may make no difference to you, but it's sort of an issue in the field that we have to sort of grapple with and figure out. Okay, so let's talk first about early variability. One study that a graduate student here at the University of Michigan, Jamal Matthews, did a few years ago, he was interested in the extent to which there was early variability in children's self-regulation skills, both through objective measurement as well as through teacher report. He wondered whether, you know, doing some kind of assessment of children would agree or not agree with what teachers reported. He was very worried about teacher biases, particularly with regard to African-American students, African-American boys in particular. But we didn't actually have a large African-American sample in the study, so he decided to focus in pretty much on gender and see what we had found. So he took a group of middle-class kindergartners in the surrounding area, and he did two different measures of self-regulation. One, a measure that we've used many, many years, over the many years, it's called head, toes, knees, and shoulders. And it probably sounds familiar, and it is pretty familiar. Essentially, you start off by saying to the child, touch your head, touch your toes, touch your knees, touch your shoulders. Wait, yeah, shoulders, okay. I can't even get it right. And essentially, even kids as young as three can do that. They have no problem. And then you say to the child, okay, now we're going to switch it up. I want you to do the opposite. So when I say touch your head, you touch your toes. Touch your knees, touch your shoulders, okay? So it's that response inhibition task. The teacher report was from a scale called the Child Behavior Rating Scale. It had a number of items about children's behavior, which a cluster of those held together as a self-regulation skill or a self-regulation construct, okay? So here is what Jamal found. This is a plot of the frequency distribution of scores for boys versus girls, okay, on this as we call it HTKS. Just remember, I'll keep calling it HTKS. And essentially what you can see is that there is, in fact, a fairly wide distribution of scores from top of about 40 all the way down to some very low scores. And in fact, you can also see that girls are doing generally better than boys, but the distribution is also somewhat less flat. Yeah. Go ahead, yeah.
God, my name is Mike Snapier, and my question is, how large was the sample? And are the tests are being done repeatedly or just once?
The sample here was... Oh, I did have it on there. Oh, sorry. I thought... Read the slide. 216.
It's hard to read.
Sorry. I'm just kidding. And it is important that these were middle-class kindergartners, okay? It's not a really representative distribution. So... if people want to ask questions, I'm okay.
It's very hard to go around.
Yeah, okay. I'm sorry.
And it's still very hard to read the numbers. And that's why it was my question.
Yeah, okay. Okay. Anyway, so basically, girls doing better than boys and the distribution isn't as broad. But for me, the critical factor was this group down here, okay? The lowest scoring students are almost exclusively boys. And that was really striking. I should say I have some of my favorite students here. we've just replicated that in a new sample here, even including some lower SES boys who form the bulk of the low scores, as you might expect. So in essence, I think that what we've discovered is, yes, there are individual differences. They can be rather large. There are some gender differences, but really it's sort of an at-risk group of boys at the bottom of the distribution for reasons that we're looking into. Okay, well, normally I torture people by asking them, okay, what happened with the teacher reports? Are they the same? Different? But I can't. Okay. In essence, they pretty much mirror the objective assessments in Jamal's data. So you're getting a pretty similar distribution, but again, this group of low-performing boys. There's this one benighted girl that I really worry about, but... and the correlations there are very strong, 0.7, 0.8, depending upon the sample that we use. So in essence, we are finding, or we did find, and this is just illustrative of many, many studies now, not just ours, that individual differences in self-regulation emerge early, at least by the start of school, probably earlier, that there is a significant gender issue, but not what typically think. Typically, when I talk to people, they talk about, well, yeah, boys, they've got that problem. Well, there are lots of boys that are doing fine. But there is a group of boys, and we should try to find out more about them, that clearly are at risk. Okay. Just briefly, Lindsay Bell, another student in our developmental program, partially replicated this study a few years ago with 400 U.S. and Chinese kindergartners. That's 400. As with any cross-cultural study, you really worry about whether the samples are comparable, but she tried as best she could to equate them on parental education, which is a strong predictor of academic achievement. And she had a different assessment of self-regulation. It was a standardized test called pair cancellation. It's a test of attentional control where you go, you have an 8x11 sheet of paper, and you have to literally look at a very busy series of lines, and whenever you come across a ball followed by a dog, you have to circle it, and it's how many you can circle in a certain period of time. That's the measure of, you know, how well you can you know, control your attention. Now, I said this was a replication. But why did I use this attention control measure and not HTKS? If I was going to replicate it, really, I would have used HTKS. The Chinese kids never made any errors on HTKS. Okay. Oh. So we already had. I think we should have stopped the study right there. But yes, clearly, and other people had found too that Chinese preschoolers are significantly, at least 6 months ahead of American preschoolers. But we were also interested not in cross-cultural differences, but in the gender differences. So the question here we put to ourselves and I put to you, okay, in this cross-cultural replication with the American sample, did we find a similar finding of gender differences? Well, yes, we did, okay? Basically, you have that group of boys, somewhere around 8 to 10% of the boys at the bottom, okay? But a lot of overlap. Now, the Chinese students, ooh. Gender differences, who says yes?
Not as much.
Who says no? I've got yes, no, not as much. What? No, yeah, right, wise guy. Okay. Nothing, okay? Chinese students, no gender differences. I have a postdoc working in my lab now who's getting really interested not only in the cross-cultural differences in the magnitude or superiority of Chinese students, but also some of the bases for it. And she has set out to try to look at early childhood experiences in daycare, because Chinese kids have a lot of time in preschool or daycare environments. And there's a lot of sort of practicing of very, you know, concrete self-regulation skills. So, whatever. Anyway, the general point of this is that we replicated this difference, and we've replicated it in our lab. So something's going on with American with a subsample of American boys, it doesn't occur in China. And actually, there's another set of studies that Shannon Wanless has done that it really doesn't occur in any of the Asian countries that have been studied so far. So Taiwan, South Korea. Yeah?
The Chinese study was done in China? Or with Chinese kids in the States?
No, in Beijing. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
No, these just a reminder, there's actually people that emailed us that can't come tonight. And they're, no, really, and they want to hear the whole presentation. So if you do have something to say, either wait till the end or raise your hand and wait for me to come around. That whole section we're going back and forth is going to have to be deleted because we can't
okay.
We can't hear it. Yeah. So we want to make sure the people that, and sometimes there's 1,000 people that will watch it online. So really, so.
So be good. In general, you know, the question arises, well, so there are these individual differences, but, you know, so what? But a lot of research in our lab and in others over the last 10, 15 years has demonstrated that self-regulation, variability in self-regulation predicts school performance from preschool through sixth grade. There's some emerging evidence that it may predict math better than reading, although that's somewhat controversial, and that working memory may be one of the key components mediating the relation between self-regulation and achievement. That's something we're also looking at in our lab. But also there is one study by Moffitt and her colleagues demonstrating that early assessments of self-regulation in childhood can have very, very long-term predictability 30 years later. They were able to predict adults' health, their wealth, and their exposure or involvement with the criminal justice system. So it's a complex story, and we're just beginning to understand it. But in terms of child factors that are relevant for schooling, I just wanted to highlight this one skill that's actually even more complicated than I'm talking about, self-regulation, that I think we really need to pay attention to. It's critical for school functioning. It's critical for school success. And in some sense, there's a growing realization that it's pervasively influential across all of life and adulthood. Okay, so I'm going to skip this over here just to go save a little bit of time. So that's a child factor, self-regulation. I think that's something new that we've discovered over the last 10 or 15 years I think we need to pay attention to. The second domain that we've been interested in, I think was really critical, is schooling experiences. And in essence, that has probably focused as much energy as anywhere on trying to understand what is effective instruction in our classrooms, and how do we get our teachers to provide it. And so essentially, one of the ways that I've been able to try to look at schooling experiences is to actually use a method called school cutoff that I stumbled on some years ago. It's a natural experiment in which you take two groups of children who are almost identical in age, but one just makes the cutoff for school entry, and one just misses the cutoff for school entry. So they're almost identical in age, but they have very different schooling experiences. And if you test them in the fall and the spring, then you can assess their degree of growth and make inferences about the impact of aspects of the schooling experience that are producing that effect. So that's what we've done. Another Michigan student, Marie Burridge, some years ago, was interested in looking or using this technique to study the effect of schooling on self-regulation. And in essence, she took some old pre-kindergartners and young kindergartners, tested them in the fall and the spring on three different tests. Essentially, the first was just to make sure that the manipulation worked that we demonstrated many years before, a test of word reading, or if you will, word decoding, from this Woodcock-Johnson standardized test. She had a working memory test called the auditory working memory subtest of the Woodcock-Johnson, in which children are presented with object names and number names. They're presented randomly, but at time of recall, you have to recall them by category, by cluster. So you're not only remembering them, but you're organizing them. And that's the critical element of working memory. And then response inhibition, okay, we're back to HTKS, back in the USA. Okay. So essentially, what you have here is a graph of the pre-K children, these geriatric pre-K children, versus the young K children, and their performance on a word reading task in the fall and the spring. And you can see essentially that the kindergarten children are superior to the pre-K children in the fall, and as if there is an effect on word decoding even of being in pre-K. But there's a separate effect accelerated in the spring indicating an independent kindergarten effect. Okay? So in essence, we've sort of replicated the effect of schooling on a basic measure of word reading. Okay, what about working memory and response inhibition? Well, in fact, we did in fact find a schooling effect on working memory in pre-K, but somewhat attenuated in kindergarten. But it does look like children's working memory may in fact be enhanced through aspects of some kind of pre-K experience. And then finally, response inhibition. Uh-oh. No schooling effect. Interesting. So we found this differentiation within components of self-regulation. In these data, we're looking at a similar kind of effect in our most recent study. But the implication is that some facets of self-regulation may be influenced by experiences in school uniquely, and some others not. And in fact, we have a little bit of evidence, correlational evidence, that another graduate student in Michigan, Claire Cameron, did some years ago, where she went in and looked and observed what was going on in the classroom. And she particularly looked at one variable that the teacher manifested, and she called it orient organize. And what it amounted to, it was the amount of time that the teacher actually spent in telling kids what was going to happen in the next few minutes or the next half hour or the next day and what they had to do to prepare for it. Okay, so it was, you know, how much did she orient and organize them per day? And we looked at the impact of variation in the amount of time that she did that on the transition, the amount of time kids took in going through transitions, and the amount of time they could spend in child-managed activity. We found some very simple but striking relations. Essentially, on the x-axis, you have the amount of time that the teacher spent in minutes per day in Orient Organize, and the amount of time the kids took to get through transitions. Okay? And essentially, what you see is the more time that she spent orienting and organizing them, if you will, the faster they went through transitions. And secondly, the more time she spent in Orient Organize in the fall, the more time children were observed to be playing independently in the spring. So, conclusions. With regard to this particular self-regulation feature or skill, we and lots of other people have found that there's an early emergence of variability, that there are some gender differences, but there are some really at-risk boys that we really need to worry about, that schooling-related experiences influence some regulation skills, working memory, but not others, like response inhibition. And a teacher's use of orienting and organizing experience contributes to better classroom functioning and more self-regulated children. So the underlying message of this for me, which is hypothetical, is that the kinds of things that teachers are doing routinely in the classroom may, in fact, enhance working memory. So when you're saying, hey, what you want you to do now is go to your cubby, get out your books, you know, bring them to the table, you know, put everything else away except the coloring book, well, that's, you know, using your working memory. And so it's possible that there's a natural effect of schooling experiences on working memory, but that teachers, at least in the United States, tend not to hammer away at kids' response inhibition. Okay, we're all about creativity. So I think the data makes sense to me, although I'm being somewhat hypothetical. Okay, so that's the individual skill, but the fact that it is malleable, I think, in some sense, gives us hope that we might actually be able to make a difference if we focus on it in a classroom situation more than we have before. Okay, instruction. When we first started out thinking about trying to understand the nature of classroom experiences, this was some maybe 15, 20 years ago, there was a raging war called the Reading Wars. How many of you have heard of the Reading Wars? Okay. Well, essentially, it was an issue of, well, what's the best way to teach beginning reading to kids? And it came down to two poles, phonics or whole language, if you will. And there was the battle had been going on for many, many years. Essentially, the research, good, solid, rigorous research over the last 20 years, has essentially showed that most children do, in fact, benefit from some degree of explicit phonics instruction, if you will, but that it needs to be embedded in some kind of real-world, meaningful comprehension activity. So the way people are describing that now is that most children need some kind of balanced instruction, and that makes a lot of sense. But when we started looking at this, we wondered, well, given what we had found about individual variability, that some children may need a different kind of balance than other children, or that there are child-by-instruction interactions, if you will. So we set out to sort of explore that in a series of studies. So But when we started sort of looking into how do you understand what's going on in the classroom, what was really surprising to us was how little quantitative empirical research had been done. A lot of the ideology that underlies sort of educational practice hadn't been substantiated, it hadn't even been tested. So in essence, we sort of set out by reading the literature and also by, you know, going into classrooms to try to understand very simply, well, what is instruction? What are the teachers doing? And so in essence, we asked, you know, if you had to tell your grandmother or whoever, you know, what's going on in this classroom, that would be the description that we would use. So for example, the teacher is now doing initial consonant stripping. We would write that down, and we'd look at the amount of time that the teacher was doing that, okay? Now, we had no idea whether this would be valid or reliable, and we had no idea if we'd get any variability, and even if we got variability, we had no idea if we were going to predict anything about children's development. But when we began looking more closely, we came up with a couple of major dimensions that we thought were really important and that we could measure and that might predict. One was, and you know, essentially, who is controlling the child's attention? Is it the teacher or the child himself or herself? One of the reasons we chose to focus on that as a potential dimension was, in this school district where we started, teachers would often say, well, take out your books and read. And the good readers would take out their books and read, and the poor readers would take out their books and do anything but read. So we thought, well, maybe part of this, for reasons of self-regulation or skill level or whatever, maybe some kids need more teacher-managed time, whereas better readers, more self-regulated kids could use more child-managed. So we asked, well, let's look at teacher versus child-managed. There's one possible dimension. Again, we have no idea. The second, though, was what's the level of the instruction? Is the instruction focusing down on letters, words, phonemes, what we called the code level, or is it a higher level, the meaning level, comprehension, discussion? And so essentially, we focused initially on these two different dimensions, and as we'll talk about, change over the school year actually became relevant when we actually looked at the findings. So those were the dimensions of instruction that we decided to focus on. The child factors that, as I said at the beginning, people had looked at that were important for success were things like letter knowledge and word decoding, comprehension, vocabulary, oral language skills, phonological awareness, and, of course, self-regulation. So essentially, we started out looking at first grade, where, in fact, really serious reading instruction begins. And we had a group of first grade children, 44% girls. They were pretty standard in terms of their IQ. We had 44 teachers in schools located in a mid-sized city. And what we did was we did 3-day-long observations in the fall, winter, and the spring, where initially I had a postdoc who did this on her own with paper and pencil, God forbid. She did written narratives recording minute by minute the teacher and child actions by the type of activity. We came up with 18 specific language arts types of activities identified and the number of minutes recorded. The activities were grouped by the dimensions of instruction that I just talked about, and I'll show you the table. And they represent the number of minutes per day that the teacher was engaged in that activity. It's useful to know when we began this study that that this district really used a whole language reading instruction through the early grades. And these data were collected in the mid to late 90s. So here's an example of how we tried to say, what is instruction? So we had a 2x2 table with teacher-managed versus child-managed, code-focused versus meaning-focused. And essentially, you could see the teacher-managed code-focused activities are alphabet, letter, sight, sound, word segmentation, all the stuff that you see at the code level in first grade. Looking over at child-managed meaning-focused, that was really things like sustained silent reading or discussion or writing. And so essentially, we split up these dimensions into this 2x2 table. And the question is, what in fact did we find? Did we see variability? Well, yes, we did. Did it predict anything? So essentially, what we found initially was that if we just looked at main effects, we didn't really find any. So variation in the amount of teacher-managed or child-managed instruction didn't predict. Amount of variation in code-focused or meaning-focused didn't predict. But for a variety of reasons that I don't have time to go into, we decided to look at these child-by-instruction interactions. And what we found essentially here is an example of how different kids need different kinds of instruction. So what this shows you is results of variation in the teacher, what we're calling a teacher-child managed code-focused minutes of instruction per day, and the spring decoding score. And these are kids whose decoding scores at the beginning of first grade were at the 25th percentile on the Woodcock-Johnson, and these were at the 90th percentile. Okay, so essentially what you can see is that for kids who were starting out as low in first grade, the more time they spent in teacher-managed, code-focused activity, the more they grew. But for kids who started out high, the more instruction they got in teacher-managed, code-focused, it actually made no difference. That drop is not significant. What about we look at child-managed, meaning-focused, or CMMF? That's up here. So here's variation in the number of minutes of child-managed, meaning-focused. So actually, just for a second, contrast the variation. The variation in teacher-managed code-focused was somewhere around 3 at the bottom, up to 15, 16 minutes. That's the most they got in this school district. Okay? Look at child-managed, meaning-focused. Okay, a minimum of about 16, all the way up to over 40 minutes a day. So this was a whole language district. They focused primarily. Well, who benefits from that? Well, in essence, the kids at the 90th percentile, the more they got child-managed, meaning-focused instruction, the more they grew. Whereas, in fact, kids who started out low actually did not make as much progress. They don't drop in their skills, but they didn't make as much progress, according to these analyses. And essentially, I'm going to sort of skip over this one for the interest of time, but we did, in fact, find that change over the school year made a difference too, so that teachers who shifted their instruction from more teacher-managed, code-focused to child-managed, meaning-focused improved, but only those kids who started out low. Okay, basically, kids who started out high needed as much child-managed, meaning-focused as they could get. So, in essence, this is just a snapshot of a whole lot of studies that we and other people have done. One, demonstrating that the most effective instruction seems to vary with the child's skills and maybe other things like self-regulation. For me, initially, it raised the question of quality. We hear a lot about, you know, what's the quality of the instruction? But in fact, you know, I sort of said to myself, well, maybe one person's high quality is another person's low quality. So that's up for grabs, too. But it leads to, it was an initial step, I think, and an important one that's being pursued by those that had worked with me before in trying to define what is effective instruction. If you had to ask that, you know, we I think, have identified two very strong dimensions of what teachers should be doing and with whom, under what circumstances, at least in first grade. Now, we've replicated these effects in pre-K, kindergarten, all the way really up to fifth grade, showing the same kinds of child-by-instruction interactions, but at the appropriate grade level. One of the things I just wanted to mention was that we were originally sitting around talking about how important these child by instruction interactions were, and it seems pretty obvious. And how, you know, why aren't they out there in the classrooms individualizing? And one of our research assistants just said, look, why don't you just shut up, put your money where your mouth is, and see, can you develop an individualizing student instruction program? So my postdoc, Carol Connor, set out to do that. And so essentially what I want to just briefly do is to talk about this intervention that she has developed. She now has published 7 studies using randomized control designs, very strong causal inference sort of designs. And essentially, I'm going to sort of talk about the components of the intervention of one of the early studies that we did. Essentially, the intervention consists of 3 parts. What we've called assessment to instruction software, which essentially means that we assess the children at the beginning of the year on we're decoding, vocabulary, comprehension, whatever else we care about. And then those scores are put into a computer program that the teacher can actually use. The second part, critically, is the individualizing student instruction part. So in essence, you have subgroups of kids, somewhere around 3 or 4 subgroups, that are clustered by their patterns of scores. And then the computer program will actually generate the exact amounts and types of instruction that that child needs to get in order to be at grade level, if they're below grade level at the beginning of the year, or to make at least a year's worth of progress. Okay. And then there's extensive professional development. So this is an example of what you see. This is a screenshot of what she can see on the computer. And it's the classroom view. And essentially what you can see is, you know, this case, 3 groups of students. And the amounts of teacher-managed meaning and code-focused and child-managed meaning and code-focused that they're going to get on that particular day. And so the whole idea is that you can program that for a day, you can program that for a week, and the teacher can actually set out which groups she, or if she has an aide, she and an aide can work with. And then she can go to the curriculum that they're using, select the kinds of activities that are going to fall under those categories, and then print that out as a lesson plan. Okay? So just briefly, this is one of the first examples that we found where we have a big treatment effect for this individualizing student instruction. Oh, as I said, now we have 7 replications of this across kindergarten through 5th grade. So this idea of instruction and child-by-instruction interactions, we've tried to push forward into an actual intervention to try to make a difference in kids' academic achievement. Okay, so finally, I'll sort of stop in just a few minutes. I've talked about the importance of this child skill, self-regulation, the critical importance of instruction, but trying to understand what is effective instruction and really taking seriously the notion of child-by-instruction interactions. Finally, parenting. It's always very controversial. What is the effect of parenting? People obviously believe that it has a big effect, but it's been hard to separate it out in a lot of different ways for a lot of different reasons. But essentially, I just want to illustrate how some of us are conceptualizing parenting and some results that we think are quite meaningful in terms of what parents are doing and what they're affecting by what they're doing. So essentially, what we've done is to, and a lot of others, to think about 3 dimensions of parenting for literacy development. The family learning environment, that's things like reading to your child, shared book reading, direct teaching of the letters of the alphabet or the sounds, okay? The whole literacy environment that parents provide. Second, though, and somewhat independently, what we've called in various times their warmth or their responsivity, it's also called autonomy support. It's just really how loving and responsive are you? Do you pay attention? Do you spend time? And do you show your child the kind of love that that they need. And the third one is management discipline, okay, of which I had none. To what extent do you actually organize your day and your child's day? To what extent do you manage their behavior? And to what extent do you discipline them, you know, when they go awry? And how consistent are you in their discipline? And we were particularly interested in the specificity of influence of these. So does the learning environment influence the same things as management discipline? So again, another student, Marie Heinemann, we took about 229 preschool children, 50% girls. This also was a middle-class sample. And we gave them a parenting questionnaire which tapped these three dimensions. The child outcomes were some literacy outcomes, alphabet naming, word reading, and picture vocabulary from this Woodcock Johnson, and social skills, cooperation, compliance, and self-control from an assessment called the SSRS. Okay. Here's an example of the parenting questionnaire items and these three sort of dimensions. So for home learning environment, frequency of teaching child letter sounds, providing your child with workbooks, play number games. There was also a separate part, which I didn't put up here, about shared book reading with your child. Autonomy support or expectations, I respect my child's opinion. I find it important for my child to be considerate of others, et cetera, et cetera. And in management discipline, once I decide to deal with misbehavior, I follow through. I get a 1 out of 5 there, but okay. So essentially what we found was that if, and just see these bolder lines as being predictors, things that really are associated. So we found the home learning environment actually strongly predicted children's alphabet scores, but also predicted their cooperation. We also found a separate effect that book reading, variation in book reading, predicted their language skill, but it actually didn't predict their literacy skills, which is a very surprising finding, but it's been found over and over again. Autonomy support actually did, in fact, predict children's cooperation, and management discipline predicted self-control and cooperation. So the idea here of this study was, in essence, that this three-dimensional model of parenting did, in fact, seem to work. So it seems to be a good example of what parents are doing to try to influence their children's overall development across areas relevant to literacy. The three dimensions actually are independent, though they're interconnected. So it essentially means that you might be really high in one dimension, but you're not necessarily high on the other. And as I said, mine was a perfect example. I mean, warmth responsivity, I was perfect. Management discipline, I was a complete zero, okay, with my first child. Second child, that was a different story. That this predicts important literacy and social skills, but it's very specific in the sense that not everything predicts everything else. So the literacy environment primarily predicts literacy, language, cognitive skills. Ironically, it also predicted cooperation, or if you will, an aspect of self-regulation. And I really puzzled over that for a while, but then I realized that, for example, when you are in bed reading to your child at night, in fact, it's a perfect time for the child to learn self-control or cooperation because they're sitting in your lap. My two kids loved being read to and sort of had to sit still if they were going to be read to. So I think there may be a connection between the actual environment of literacy and the development of, in a sense, an aspect of self-regulation. So just to give you a sense of this research, I mean, there are some limitations. We used a questionnaire here, as you see, we had used behavioral measures in some of the other studies. And there's a lot of social desirability. So parents don't want to say, no, I hate my kids and I never have warm, responsive moments with them. And so the variability is probably a lot less than it might be if we were able to get behavioral measures. Over the years, we have, including my colleague here, Pam Davis-Keen, tried to get more behavioral measures, going into homes and seeing exactly what parents are doing with kids. And so that lack of variability from the questionnaire can make a real difference. Anyway, so what I've tried to highlight here tonight in terms of predictors of success is that there isn't any one predictor, that there are factors all over the place. But what we focused on, I think, are three critical ones: child factors, schooling factors, and parenting factors. And in recent years, I think what we've discovered is that there is this skill not yet focused on in school that I think we might want to pay attention to. So my recommendations are that we try as best we can, parents, teachers, whoever else, to promote self-regulation in children. It's going to have long-term consequences. Secondly, as we say, strive to individualize. Again, both in the schooling environment and the parenting environment. And the last thing, I think, is that parenting matters. Sometimes it's suppressed in the discussion of the variability that we see. But over the years, we've seen that, you know, preschool experience can have an effect. Schooling experience can have an effect. But it doesn't necessarily get kids to where they want to be or where we want them to be. And so I think we have to, as much as we can, emphasize parenting, and especially early parenting, in conjunction with effective instruction. So with that, I think basically we've gone a long way. I think we've really understood, in some sense, exactly what those kinds of skills are that are really important for success. And in some cases, at least looking at schooling and parenting, what we as a society could do to really promote and maybe make them better. Thanks a lot. Yeah.